Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Rob. Hey, I'm so excited about our guest today.
Me too.
We're going to be talking to David Thomas. Mm-hmm. He talks about the stages of development for boys. And, you know, having raised a couple of boys, Rob, I do have to admit that sometimes as a parent, I was left scratching my head and wondering, what was that boy thinking? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, Rob, you grew up. Do you think your parents ever thought that?
More than once, for sure. I mean, we did some crazy things. I remember once my brother and I thought it'd be funny if we got out some fake blood, put it on ourselves and run through the front door and pretend we just got into a car accident.
And?
Oh, my mom looked at us and she said, "That's fake blood."
Smart mom.
Oh yeah, yeah. Not easily fooled. But you know, it's those experiences that make us all scratch our head.
Absolutely. So, yeah, David Thomas is a well-known author. He wrote a book called Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys. And he's a therapist. He's been in practice for 25 years in the area of child development, particularly as it relates to boys. And he's a well-known speaker and also has a podcast called Raising Boys and Girls. So let's jump into our interview with David Thomas.
Yeah, let's meet David. David, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you all.
Yeah, it's a snowy day over here in Oro, and it sounds like it's warmer there in Nashville.
It is. I'm jealous of your snow. You hardly see it anymore here, so I'm going to need you all to photograph and remind me what it looks like.
Well, we're pretty well done with it after a few weeks, so you can have it in Nashville for a few weeks if you want. But listen, I wanted to talk to you today, and Tony, I'm here with Tony Newhoff as well, and we wanted to talk to you about really specifically about boys and what makes boys unique, and you write about them in your books, you counsel boys. Tell me, what got you interested in this area of counseling and such?
I think if I were to think back on the point of origination, I was a camp counselor in college. During my undergraduate years, I worked at a camp with elementary age kids. And I can remember one of my colleagues commenting to me at some point along the way that I was the guy they would come get with homesick kids. I was the guy they would come to seem to find when kids were just struggling in different ways, kids who were navigating divorce and maybe just feeling a lot of the things they were feeling while they were away from home. And so it just seemed at that point in my life already that it felt really natural for me to sit with kids in hard moments and that I felt really comfortable in that space. And so I detoured in my major in college before I landed back in psychology and then pursued my graduate work. But I think I may have always known, or certainly from that point forward, that this really was the work that felt so comfortable to me and that I felt called to. And so I've been incredibly grateful to have been able to do this work and have been practicing as a therapist at this amazing place called Daystar Counseling in Nashville for almost 25 years now. And I still today love the work I do. I'm so grateful I get to sit with kids and families. And as grateful as I am for all of my training, my undergrad and graduate training, I feel like I have learned more just sitting with kids in this work over the years that is so much of what I hope to really bring to the writing and the teaching that I do. That to me feels like just the most valuable content of what they've really taught me in the experience of just sitting with families over these decades.
That sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. I know that this can be a far longer conversation, but I wonder if you could describe for our listeners in a high-level way the stages of development that you generally teach parents about.
I'd be glad to. And it felt so important to me in the book I wrote on boys to really start there. And maybe that was as much for me as for anyone else, because I think I really need to have some categories to think as clearly as possible about boy development, which I think a boy's development, a boy's brain can feel like a confusing place sometimes. So these categories were hopefully a way to make development a little more clear. And so I break it down into five stages, and I call stage one of a boy's development, which is roughly the ages of birth to four, the explore years. Right. And then I call the second stage of development, which is 5 to 8, the lover stage. And I often laugh and say, if I could ever freeze a boy in his development, I would freeze him in stage two. I mm-hmm. think boys are full of some of their best stuff between 5 and 8 years of age. And we can talk more about why that is. But they graduate into what I call the individual stage, which is roughly 9 to 12. So right up to the adolescent years. And then the wanderer stage is 13 to 17. And I think most developmental theorists would say that's the worst episode of a boy's life. It's, you know, that period that you all know well is just plagued by so much change. And he's in the middle of a biological tsunami that's right. wreaking mm-hmm. havoc on his body and emotions. And so that's a really complicated stretch. And honestly, as hard as that stage is, I love talking about that stage with parents because I think it feels so scary and overwhelming for so many boys sure. to pass through, so many parents to love a boy through it. And so I'm honestly always excited to get to talk about it because I hope it can make it feel less overwhelming, both for young men I spend time with who are passing through and for parents who are caring for boys. And then the final stage, which is, I think is an amazing movement forward, is what I call the warrior stage. And that's boys roughly between the ages of 18 and the early to mid 20s. And as we all know well, boys are later than girls to finish out yeah. adolescence. Most developmental theorists would say for a girl, they're finishing out somewhere around 19 to 20. But for boys, well, I actually will ask that question sometimes when I teach a class on boys, like, do any of you know or want to guess the age when most developmental theorists agree that a boy is done with his adolescence? And usually the first answer is someone saying 45.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I get it. And don't we all know at least one adult man who looks like he's still trying to finish out? But most would say it's somewhere around 22 to 25. And even that piece of information feels so important because I think if we're lengthening the timeline with a boy's development accurately, it will affect our expectations of him mm-hmm. in a way that is so helpful. You know, I think we launch boys out into the world at 17 and 18 and say, go be a grown-up. And the reality is they may have a good 8 years of adolescence left to finish out. And so I think it allows us to think differently about sending him away and the kind of oversight and support we'd want to offer him, how he would spend his summers of the mm-hmm. college years. And so again, just really thinking strategically about the importance of development and how I think that impacts all of how we care for boys, teach to boys, discipline boys, help them structure their lives. So thank you for inviting me to talk about it on the front side of our conversation. You all can probably tell I feel passionate about
opportunity
to talk about development.
Absolutely. Do you think, David, that these stages are lengthening? People have talked about how adolescence seems to be a phase in life that is lengthening with a lot more adolescents staying home longer, you know, not going to college or working or getting started with their adult life as soon as we used to in the past. I think of my parents, for example, they had me when they were 21 and that was the norm. You know, you started a family when you were 21. Right now, that would be considered quite young. And so do you think that there is actually elongation of some of these stages?
I do. And I would say I'm seeing more evidence in my practice. And I think the statistics nationally reflect this too, of boys getting stuck in development in different moments for longer periods of time and having difficulty getting unstuck. And there again is where I'm just so grateful to get to talk about development, because anything we can do to either prevent him getting us stuck or to help him get unstuck, I want to be about, because I talk so much throughout development about how boys crave purpose. And I think when they feel stuck and like I'm not moving forward, inevitably that's going to affect his purpose. It's going to affect his sense of self. So many things that I think can become damaging to how he sees himself, how he sees relationships in the world. And so, yes, any opportunity I'm given, I'm grateful. So thank you both again. We could have the conversation we're having tonight. It feels important.
Yeah, and like we said, this could be a whole hour-long conversation just talking about the different stages. I know you do a whole podcast on it called Raising Boys and Girls, and that certainly is a great resource as well. David, how does the brain of a boy lead him to think and behave differently than, say, a girl? I think there's both upsides and downsides to that. I think you described that quite clearly as well. So can you explain a bit more about that?
I'm glad to. Right out of the gate, when I talk about the boy brain, I talk about how I believe he's hardwired for activity and movement. And anytime we can think about his environment to allow for that, to support that, I think it's a win. And so, you know, I talk about in the beginning, we know that from the earliest moments, a little girl's frontal lobes grow at an earlier stage and are generally more active. And our frontal lobes, obviously, and form so many things, our executive decisions. It's why little girls tend to think first and then act second. And it's why boys tend to do more of the opposite, act first and then think. Maybe on the way to the ER, I shouldn't have ridden my bike off that ramp or whatever. His brain is uniquely designed that informs how he operates in the world. And I believe in response to that should inform how we respond to him. But it doesn't always necessarily inform that.
Right, because obviously, you know, culture and how we nurture has an influence on that as well. So, I mean, what are the relative factors when it comes to, say, the biology versus the environmental factors that might lead to those differences?
Yes, and I think it's always a mix of both. Yeah. I think, you know, when I think about the biological factors, I think about how often I hear parents voice frustration. I sat with two sets of parents just today who were talking about frustrations they bumped up against last night in the evening ritual of boys finishing homework, taking showers, heading to bed, and how frustrating that process was for them. And both sets of parents separately talked about having given him instructions that he, you know, maybe 2 to 3 instructions, and he made it about halfway through the first and didn't accomplish anything else. And so I jumped right in to say, you know, one of the things we know to be true about the boy brain is that we're more singularly focused creatures as males. And, you know, females have this remarkable ability to multitask, to take in more sensory data, these different ways that their brains are designed uniquely and remarkably. But their capacity to sequence, to, you know, be told 4 things to do and then move forward with that is pretty strong, and not the same with us. And it's not that we aren't intelligent creatures. It's just that if we're bombarded with a lot of instruction and information, we can get lost a little more easily. And so I'll even say to my wife, when she, you know, if I'm heading out the door to the store to grab some things, she's like, you know what, and grab some lemons and the 3. And I'm like, could you text that to me? And yes. I'm going to remember the first 2, not the last 4. And so, yeah. If you think about that with the boys we love, I think it allows us to engage him in a very different way. So, you know, I talk about using a full sensory approach with boys anytime we're giving them instructions. So I sometimes will use an example when I teach and call an adult man up front and say, okay, I want you to imagine that you're my 5-year-old son and we're going to have a conversation about how you leave dirty clothes all over the house. And I invite the audience to think about, watch this engagement. And I put my hand on his shoulder and I start by saying his name. And then I just give 1 instruction, you know, hey, dirty clothes, go in the basket, say it back to me, have him repeat it back. And all of what I'm hoping to do in that example is just allow them to think a little differently about what exchanges could look like. And I'll draw attention to the ingredients and mechanics of that. Like, did you notice the full sensory approach? I was touching him the entire time we're talking. I was, you know, starting with his name, I was making eye contact. I was pointing. I was allowing him to say back to me what he'd heard to make sure he got it, all those things. And I said, you know, what I think happens instead is that, you know, every day cars, SUVs, vans pull into driveways. And I think boys hear things like this, you know, like, hey, I do not want those muddy cleats in my house, so leave those out back. Go ahead and hang up your backpack. Remember, we've got that big science project to work on tonight. So I want you to go on up and take your shower first and then come on down. We're going to do dinner and then jump on that science project.
Mm-hmm. All those things will get done for sure.
Only to find him wandering around the house, building a Lego project, playing with the dog over here. And then we're so frustrated. Like, what are you doing? Didn't you hear me say we've got all these things to do? And in that moment, I think that's on us. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think we gave too many instructions. I think that shouting from afar approach isn't useful to him. And I acknowledge, you know, if I were to give an example like that, I understand he has all those things to do, but let's break it down into manageable parts. So what would it look like to just say, hey, drop your muddy cleats out back and find me. And then we can affirm him, praise him, say, fantastic. Now go put your backpack up. But we're breaking it down in ways that I think are better honoring his hardwiring and his design.
David, do you think, because when you start describing, say, the features of a normal boy and what he and how he thinks and the strategies to, you know, mitigate some of the difficulties with that, you're almost describing ADHD, for example. And, you know, I wonder if it's you've noticed this or whether it's been your experience that a lot of these boys who may be normal are actually getting diagnosed with a disorder that maybe is not correct.
I do believe that. And it's been my experience in my practice as well. And I would certainly want to begin by saying, I believe in the legitimacy of that diagnosis. And sure. I'm so supportive of treatment. And I have seen such great evidence in my work of boys who benefited from our interventions. But it is to say, I think you're right. So many of the approaches that I would just encourage parents to take on a daily basis with all boys look like the modifications that we might make in academic environments and at home. Like if we're going to make a first academic adjustment with a young man struggling with attention deficit in a classroom, it's going to start with a teacher walking by and just touching him gently on the back or calling out his name to call his attention back to the content and instruction. So yes, I think all boys benefit from so many of those kinds of supports and interventions, and even their desire for movement that I talked about on the front side and their mm-hmm. energy, all those things looks like ADHD in a lot of moments, which may simply be an active boy who sadly in our academic environments isn't getting near the opportunity I had growing up to be active, to be moving, to have longer recess, all those things that I think we could talk all day about boys in school, but I think make a lot of boys look ADHD in a classroom setting because they're fidgety and restless and needing more movement opportunity.
Sure. Now, David, you note that failing to recognize the differences between girls and boys may lead some parents or teachers or caregivers to make certain mistakes. Can you say a bit more about that?
I'm happy to. I think one of the biggest mistakes that we can make with the boys we love, one of the biggest adjustments that we could make to benefit them would be thinking about how many words we use. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to spend much of a boy's life talking at him and very little of that landing on him. So if there were one difference I was going to start with, it would be that one, and one adjustment I think we could make, which is even some of why I love using those kinds of examples to think about the differences. And I'll sometimes laugh with the moms in the room and say, you know, just out of the amazing way that you're designed, you have often more words, more vocabulary. And if I were to have invited you up and said, I'm going to be your 5-year-old son, you be my mom, talk to me about how I leave dirty clothes everywhere. You know, it oftentimes would have involved more questions like, now, sweetheart, where do we leave dirty clothes when we take those off? Do we
leave
the house in the corner of the bathroom? And I acknowledge that, you know, often I think mom's approaches would be kinder, warmer, but probably a lot more verbiage and where I think boys could get lost in that. So that's one of the first adjustments I'm always quick to speak to that I think is a part of those differences. Mm-hmm. And then two, I think ongoing with engagement, I talk about how girls have a capacity to engage conversation and eye-to-eye contact for longer and how eye-to-eye feels more threatening for boys. So, for example, in the work I do, it's rare that I would stay seated in my office, in my chair, and a boy on the couch in my office for the full 50-minute session. It's very rare. I'm going to do a lot of experiential. We operate, our office is in a house and we have a backyard, and we laugh about when we were building out this space, we said to the architect, we can compromise on a lot of things, but the backyard and the basketball court are non-negotiable, because half the work we do is with boys and we've got to have space where we can move with them. And it's fascinating the kinds of conversations we can have with boys as we're throwing a football, as we're shooting hoops and retrieving the ball, as we're walking our therapy dogs who are part of the practice. It's amazing the things that will come out. And boys have some of their best conversations side by side, where girls might have those more naturally face to face.
Yeah, it's probably why I feel like the great conversations happen in a car when you're driving looking forward. And but I see the same thing too, David, in my practice. You know, when I'm talking to boys, it's much better just to get down, and young boys especially, just kind of play with them with some of the stuff on the ground. And they always like to move something in their hands. I have a Rubik's Cube in my office. That's the first thing they go to when they don't have the iPad anymore. So they go to the Rubik's Cube and they just kind of fiddle with that while we talk. And it seems to just make it easier for some reason.
It does. I have a box full of gadgets and fidgets that's sitting on my coffee table that every boy has access to. And if I do a joint session with parents, I often will have parents correct them when they immediately grab something. They'll say, "No, pay attention," or "Make eye contact when he's talking." And I'll always say respectfully to the parents, "I'm so okay. I'm really okay. I have those things available for a reason, because I think it's easier to have the conversations when he can move something in his hands."
And that must be hard for classrooms too, you know, because the expectation really is that, especially in the older grades, that kids sit still and listen. Now, there is more acceptance of, you know, difference in learning styles, and definitely amongst boys and girls in schools. Maybe not every school, but certainly in the schools that I'm familiar with here locally, there is more opportunity for boys to move around and to take breaks, for example, especially in certain boys that just need that to focus. And because it's tempting for us to think, oh, they're not focusing, they're not paying attention, when in reality, that's what they need to do to pay attention.
They do. And that's a great reminder, going back to the question you all ask about the brain and even the differences. You know, one of the things we know to be true about the brain is that all of our brains, male and female, go into what's called a rest state. And the male brain goes into a rest state twice as often and for longer periods of time. So we have to wake the male brain up more often. And I think it's where I'll challenge parents with homework. You know, I think one of the worst things we could say to a boy is, "You're going to sit right here at this kitchen table until every single problem on that math worksheet is done." You know, we might as well say, "You're going to sit right here at this table until you go to sleep," because he probably will, as opposed to saying, "You know what, I'm going to set a timer. Let's do 10 minutes of good math. And then I'd love for you to go outside and jump on the trampoline for a few minutes, or run some laps, or go up and down the stairs if it's cold outside, and take what I call a brain break." And I love the idea of introducing that to boys early on. I had a college age young man who just came in to see me while he was home on his holiday break. And I saw this young man when he was in fifth grade for the first time. And he said, "David, I still think about you talking to me about brain breaks." And he said, "I've even set my schedule up at college to allow for that. And I don't do more than two classes in a row before I would come back and go run." And it's amazing to me how different a student I am when I allow for that.
Well, good for him. That's great self-awareness and really learning to cope with that.
So, David, I would imagine there are parents out there who have young boys who are wondering where their boys lie on that spectrum of being, you know, very kinesthetic learners versus, you know, some boys, you know, would have the personality to stay a bit more still and, you know, have characteristics that just aren't as quite as active. How do you advise parents to go about figuring out how to best coach their boys or account for their wiring?
That's great. I really do believe early on with boys, particularly in stage one, and I would say the beginning of stage two, they are primarily tactile and kinesthetic learners. They've been more in that direction. And then I think as boys grow and develop, they become more visual, spatial, and experiential learners. And there again, going back to that adjustment, notice nowhere in that list was that he's primarily an auditory learner. You know, that I think in all stages, at all ages, that's on the top five list. So holding on to that. But with that shared, your question's a great question, that there are boys who, you know, can bend in that direction better. And they, you know, might primarily learn visually, but they're strong auditory learners as well. So I think it really is about studying him. We talk a lot in our parenting content about becoming a student of your child. And I think that's true within your question of watching him as he grows and develops and beginning to, over the course of his development, develop an understanding of what we might call his overall learning profile. And back to that example, that he might be a guy who could do 15 to 20 minutes of good math before he needs a brain break. And I think alongside him, helping him figure out those things for himself. Like, I noticed this about you. I'll have parents who'll say, like, it drives me crazy that he's spinning a fidget spinner while he's working on spelling words. And I'm like, but if it helps him with retaining the information and you're noticing that he can execute it with consistency, I would not only let that go, I'd support it. And so I think that's all a part of becoming a student so that we figure those things out with him.
Yeah, so important. And that leads to this other thought, you know, that I've had here just now while we were talking about every kid's different too, right? You can't just sort of do one size fits all and every boy is going to go through these exact stages at the exact same time. In the same way, I mean, boys are all different. And so I'm sure you would agree with this too, David, that these descriptions are more generalities and more averages as opposed to hard and fast stages and descriptions.
I absolutely agree. And even when I teach at length on those stages, I'll encourage parents on the front side, hold these ages loosely, because every boy's going to move at his own pace. And I also say, I think it's common that boys would straddle two stages. They'd have a foot in one stage and a foot in another, or sometimes they go backwards and then move forwards again. That's not at all uncommon to a boy's development. That might look somewhat different with a girl's development forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, we talked recently to one of your colleagues, Sissy, about Sissy Goff, about anxiety in girls. And I want to be cognizant of the fact that boys can get anxious too, and it often looks different. You want to comment a little bit about that, about how anxiety might present in boys that might be different from how girls might present with anxiety or excessive worrying?
I would, and I'm thrilled you got an opportunity to talk with my colleague, Sissy Goff. Mm-hmm. She has written an amazing book on girls and anxiety that I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's an amazing resource. And when we teach together on that content, we talk about a lot of the strategies we use in our practice with boys with anxiety are the same or very similar to those. I do think it often will present with some differences, but sometimes it doesn't look all that different. But I think with many things with boys, Sissy and I talk and we teach together about how girls can tend to go inward more and boys outward more. Yeah. And so, you know, where she might become smaller and more fearful in the face of anxiety, he might become bigger, more angry and volatile. And I think that's true with anxiety and depression. I think with depression, I see some boys in my practice who present with more classic symptoms of sadness and they're lethargic. But generally speaking, it looks more angry and irritable than it does sad and lethargic. And so I think the same with anxiety, rather than he's kind of small and fearful, a lot of times it's more he's more stubborn, rigid, trying to control a lot of externals, which again, I think can be true for girls as well. But that's where I think it's easy to get tripped up. I often have parents say that, like, he doesn't seem anxious to me. He seems angry. And lean into that, because that's common, but I think both with anxiety and depression with boys.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I do see a lot of boys who just are very irritable, very emotional. And to many people, that does not look like anxiety, but yet anxiety is kind of the driving factor there. They're worried about something. They're trying to control their surroundings. And that's how it shows up.
And what ages are you finding boys or parents are bringing their boys to you for to explore anxiety?
Earlier and earlier, I'm sad to say. And I'm sure you all aren't surprised to hear me say that. I know it lines up with your experience, but I'm jolted by how early, and that, you know, the stats keep saying the onset is earlier and earlier. And mm-hmm. so once upon a time in early in my work, I think I could have counted on one hand the number of boys I was seeing under the age of 8 who were struggling with anxiety. And I couldn't begin to count how many I'm seeing at this point. It's shocking how early it presents and how early we're seeing kids and all the different ways that I think it shows up. And I, you know, the one benefit of getting to kids early is the earlier we can intervene and offer support and educate parents and equip kids, that certainly is better in offsetting things for the long journey. But I'm grieved to see kids so young who are struggling in those ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. If we could switch gears a bit, David, can we talk about the transition to the awkward stage of puberty? I'm sure there are some parents listening right now who are either facing that stage or just entering it and would really welcome some of your advice about how to handle that stage. Mm.
It is, as we mentioned earlier, just a complicated moment in a boy's life and a parent's journey in supporting him. And it's common that boys would become less engaged, less talkative. Even the piece we were talking about with anxiety, they can become even more irritable. Those biological shifts they're experiencing, boys are experiencing surges of testosterone pouring through their bodies every day that are just wreaking havoc on their systems. And it's obviously going to affect them physically, but emotionally as well. And I don't think parents can do enough leaning into reminding themselves. Often we know these things, but we just need reminders on all of what's going on that explains so much. And that's not giving him a permission slip to be his worst self or to be disrespectful and awful, but it is to say it's so important to understand that. And I read years ago an author who laughingly said, you know, it really should be illegal in this country that you should have children. Women should be able to have children at a certain point, because if their adolescence intersects with our menopause, that is way too much emotion under one roof. Like, that's an illegal event.
Right.
And I laugh about that with parents, but I go back to it often because I can't tell you how many moms I've had say that the experience of menopause was one of the most helpful reminders in terms of understanding what's going on for their sons and adolescents, because it's this reality of I cannot control my emotions. I'm doing great one moment, I'm really irritable the next. I'm burning up one moment and freezing cold the next, and just this sense of I don't feel at home in my own skin. And I think that's important to go back to. I would say to parents, I think the tendency when he's talking less is to engage less. And I don't think there's a point in development when he needs us to press in more. So I challenge parents, be so creative in how you engage him. In fact, I laughingly say with parents, it's rarely a successful experiment to go out to dinner with a stage one boy. He can't sit still long enough. He's probably going to be crawling on the floor under the booth and you're going to feel frustrated. Just don't spend money eating out with explorers. It's rarely a successful experiment. Save your money because you want to eat out with an adolescent boy all the time because he loves to eat and he's growing and he's hungry. And there's proof to that age old saying of the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. And maybe the conversations that I think we can have with boys around food. And so I laughingly say the secret ingredient is queso. You know, it's amazing how chips and queso will get a boy talking the way nothing else will. So
yeah,
think on that as an example of, you know, connecting with him may be more around eating out. Connecting with him may be buying tickets to a concert that I don't love the music, but he does. Connecting with him may be going to see more movies that don't interest me as much, but he's all about. And so I love when I hear parents talk about feeling a sense of breaking through with him when they get creative in that way. And then I would add to that list too, though we've come a good ways, we have a long way to go in terms of talking with boys before endearing adolescents about their bodies, about their sexuality, about relationships. I think we, generally speaking, do a pretty great job with girls talking openly with them. I often will say to parents, you know, when I teach, I know there's not a parent in the room who's not fully committed to talking with their daughter well before she would begin her cycle, before she'd have her first period, because we wouldn't want any girl we loved to not feel prepared for that moment when it happened. But we don't often feel the same urgency in talking with boys about their bodies. And I think it's a part of why the stats are what they are on boys and pornography, because what do we all do in this day and age when we're curious about anything? We Google it. And so I think he's going to be curious about his body, about relationships, so many things. And if we're not having an ongoing dialogue with him about those things and stepping in with that kind of intentionality, it always makes sense to me why boys would go to the internet with their questions or their curiosity. And I just am grieved every time I read the newest stats around that with boys.
Yeah, because that, I mean, that is something that's really changed over the last 10, 15 years, is the ready access to pornography and such. And sometimes it's a difficult topic to talk about with boys, and like, how do you start that conversation? But it is important to, first of all, to recognize, I think, right, that this is where boys are going to get their information from and learn from.
Yes, absolutely. It is such an important conversation. And to not allow his awkwardness to dictate our movement forward. And I think it often does. I'll have parents say, he just looks so disinterested, or, you know, he was turning away from me, those kinds of things. And that's where I'd go back to our conversation earlier about, think about doing it differently. You know, think about not sitting down face to face, eye to eye, but, you know, think about walking the family dog and talking about some of those things. Think about even, and not just those heavier topics, but just his day. I'll have parents say of adolescent boys, he just won't tell me anything about his day. You know, I'm driving home, and I think Sissy may have spoken about this. She and my colleague Melissa Trevathan wrote an amazing book called The Back Door to Your Teen's Heart. And the opening statement of that book is, to the degree that kids can predict you, they will dismiss you. And I think that happens with, isn't that amazing? To the degree that kids can predict you, they'll dismiss you. And I think that happens on those rides home from school. You know, the predictable questions. How was your day? Fine. Did anything happen? No. You know, like, and think about, what if we were to just ride home and turn on some music and enjoy that, or even say to him, hey, buddy, I'm guessing you expended a whole lot of mental energy today and might love to ride home and not have to talk. What if we just turn on some music and then let him come home, eat, because we talked about the importance of that.
Yep.
And then if he goes outside to shoot some hoops, go outside and retrieve the ball. He's had some space. He's had some food. He's had some quiet. And while he's shooting hoops and you're retrieving the ball, then ask some questions about his day. And he's not aware that he's talking. So that's but one example of the different ways I think we could engage unpredictability to get access to more of what's going on in his life and help him talk about his experience.
That's so important. And I think what you highlight there, David, is just the importance of being intentional, first of all, but also being still having fun with your kids too. I mean, you can't just always have the heavy conversations all the time and only heavy conversations. You just need to have fun and go out there and play and just spend time with your kids. And then those conversations will just come naturally too. So
agreed. I think one other last thought I had in response to your great question about this season is, I know we're often coached wisely in the direction of avoiding one word answer questions and moving toward open-ended. And I very much agree with that. I would only add to that that I think sometimes that feels too big and vague and scary for boys.
Okay.
And so I would challenge parents to make it a little more concrete and you know, say something like, what were the two best moments? What were the two hardest moments of today for you? Or one of the best, one of the hardest. So do you see how just massaging the question that way, I think for a lot of adolescent boys feels more manageable. Like, I don't know what to say about all the stuff that happened in my day, but if you're asking me something about one good thing, one hard thing, I could probably a little more easily put my finger on that.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think we have to be good conversationalists and really practice those skills.
Well, and you mentioned not being predictable and having fun. And I think you even remind parents that, I mean, it's okay to play a practical joke or two. Do you have any examples? Anything come to mind?
Yes, I believe in that so strongly. And I think even that is an example of that unpredictability. I think boys so expect us to always be in that role of teaching and coaching and instructing and correcting, you know, and I think when we step out of that place, it's awesome. And even if they look or report they're embarrassed, like, I can't tell you how much I love boys telling stories like that. Like, I had one last week and he was like, my mother was dancing again at home.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember thinking, I love that mom for that. I love it. Because I think in adolescence, with that irritability, that surliness, we can let that start to set the temperature in our homes and yes. miss the importance of being playful and practical jokesters and those kinds of things. And so I really couldn't advocate for that strongly enough. That is one form of that unpredictability.
Yeah, and that's true for boys and girls. I think we all need that. You know, we need to have that fun in our life and a little bit of, you know, not taking everything so seriously too.
Yes.
Wow, David, I think we could talk a lot longer about this, and but you've really shared a lot of great insight into the minds of boys and how they work and what makes them tick, etc. Where could parents go to find out more about this? Can you point us to some resources that might be helpful for them?
Well, our content is all housed at raisingboysandgirls.com. So if they were to jump on our website, it would lead them to the book that I mentioned that I've written on boys. And then my dear colleague, Sissy Goss, written a great book on girls as well, her book on anxiety that I mentioned. And then we have a podcast and just kind of everything that is a part of the work that we do is really housed there. But I would love to also advocate for a book that I did not write that I wish I had written as well, that's in keeping with our conversation today. There's an extraordinary book that's been out for years and years, but I think is still such an invaluable resource. It's a book called Raising Cain, and the subtitle is Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. And I really wish every parent of a boy could read that at some point over the course of his growing up. It's just an outstanding resource that I think is enlightening, particularly in that frustrating journey of trying to get access to more of what's going on in his heart when it's hard to talk with him.
Yeah.
That's great. We'll include links to these resources in our show notes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And your book's called Wild Things. It's a great book. Thanks for sharing your insights from that with us today and from your just experience over so many years of counseling boys. Thanks again, David, for joining us.
Yeah, this has been invaluable. Thanks so much.
Thank you both. You were so enjoyable to talk with. I've loved this time. I'm grateful for it.
Okay. We are too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Rob, I love how David Thomas talks about the stages of development.
Me too.
For boys. It's so important for all of us to understand the stages that boys progress through and how they learn, how they communicate, so that we can really get into their world and help them grow and develop. I would think that some of the things he talks about sometimes end up as problems in your office, Rob, as a pediatrician.
Yeah, I love that part of our conversation where we just talked about what is normal. It is just so important, I think, for parents to realize what's normal behavior. I mean,
for a boy.
Exactly. Because I think the problem there is that sometimes we can take normal behavior and kind of see the raw end of that and think, oh, this is something that's wrong, or this is something that needs to be diagnosed. And then we are just really pathologizing normal behavior.
Right, such as?
For example, ADHD, right? And absolutely, there are kids with ADHD. And the key distinguishing factor when you make a diagnosis is that there has to be day-to-day impairment.
Okay.
And that's the difference.
Impairment in
day-to-day functioning.
Okay.
Right?
Including schoolwork.
School, relationships, activities.
Okay.
If that dysfunction is not there, it's not a disorder. And so if we can get around some of these difficulties with our boys by simply just relating to them in different ways, communicating with them, you know, and
giving them clear direction.
Exactly.
One at a time.
Yeah. if we can get around some of these difficulties with just those simple strategies and steps, you know, then we can realize that we're not dealing with pathology here. We're dealing with just normal boy behavior. And let's embrace it and appreciate it and work with it.
Yes, absolutely.
So thanks for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share this episode by sharing the link. Subscribe to the podcast. That way you'll get every episode downloaded automatically for you to listen to. And you won't miss a single episode. And also look us up on social. We're on Instagram, Smart Family Podcast, and also our website, smartfamilypodcast.com, for further resources, show notes, blogs, etc.
Well, thanks for joining us today at the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you build family relationships that last, boost your parenting to the next level, and help you cut through the noise. And why do we do this? Because we want to help you love being home.